ask you tonight to write down on a card what you know about Adonai, Eleazar, Shema. You know anything about these guys? How about Abishai or Benaiah? If I were to ask you on your attendance card tonight, before it was passed in, to write down what you know about any of these men, Adonai, Eleazar, Shema, Abishai, or Benaiah, what would you write down? Could you tell us what part of the Bible they are in? Could you pinpoint what particular part of the Old Testament they might be found in? Could you pinpoint who they might be associated with? For some of us, just knowing how to spell their names and how to get close to pronouncing them, that would be accomplishment enough for us. Who are these guys? I know we've had read from 1 Samuel chapter 22, and I want us to look at that as we go through this lesson. But I want to invite you tonight to turn in your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 23, where we read in 2 Samuel chapter 23 about David's mighty men. And there are several that are mentioned here, and we don't have time to look at all of them tonight. But I want us to look at what 2 Samuel chapter 23 tells us about Adonai, Eleazar, Shema, Abishai, and Benaiah. And what is it about these five men in particular? What lessons are there that we can learn from these five men that we can take with us into 2010? We only have a few days left in 2009. Can you believe that it's already 2010? Can you believe that it's already... Do you remember Y2K and all the concern there was about computers? Can you believe we even had computers 10 years ago? And that we were concerned about what was going to happen to them, and that was 10 years ago. Time is flying, and it's already the year 2010 almost. What lessons can we take from these five men as we go into this new year? Did it stand out to you, as Bill read, about David's men as they came to him? Did you notice who came to David? Who did he become captain over? Who became David's mighty men? 1 Samuel 22 tells us that it was all of those, everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented. You think there was anybody who was not gathered to him? I mean, find one person in here tonight that's not in debt. Be hard to do, wouldn't it? Find one person in here tonight who's maybe not in distress about something. Hopefully not a lot of you are discontented. Hopefully not a lot of you are troubled in soul or have some ill will towards someone else. Maybe you do, but we won't ask you to raise your hands, right, Grant? We won't ask you to raise your hands. Think about these men that had come to David. And in 2 Samuel chapter 23, we are told about some of his mighty men or some of these valiant men and what they did. And I think there's some simple lessons, simple principles and truths that we can take from the lives of these five men and apply them to ourselves tonight and apply them to our lives as we go into 2010. First of all, look in 2 Samuel chapter 23, look in verse 8. Because in verse 8, we are introduced to this first one, Adonai. You might think it's a dino, or like dino, that thing? That was a dinosaur creature in the Flintstones. But this is Adonai. I don't think he was related to anybody in the Flintstone family. But in 2 Samuel 23 and verse 8, we're introduced to him. And it says at the end of that verse, he was called Adonai the Eznite because he had killed 800 men at one time. Some translations tell us that he did so with a spear. Here's Adonai. A man who did so much with so little. He killed 800 men alone by himself with a spear. Tried to figure out a way to help us to understand what an accomplishment that was. When we moved in this building, they told us that this auditorium could seat 725. I don't think so. But let's say this auditorium could seat maybe 700, which is maybe more realistic if it was packed. This man killed 800. Suppose you had to battle this auditorium when it was completely full and all you had was one spear. It would be easy if everybody would just line up in a line, wouldn't it? I say easy. It would be easier if everyone would just line up in a single file line and come at you that way, but that's not how they approached Adonijah. He killed 800 men at one time with a spear. He did so much with so little. The lesson's obvious, isn't it? How much do you do with what you have? Somebody says, well, I don't have much. Neither did Adonijah. How much do you do with what you have? How much do you do with your time? Somebody says, well, I don't have much time. That's the point. How much do you do with the time that you have? Does everybody in here have the same amount of time as everybody else in here? I believe we do. What do we do with our time? How is it that some of us can stretch our time a little bit better than others? How is it that some of us can make more of our time and do more with our time than some others? How much do you do, however little time you might think you have, how much do you do for God with that time? How much do you do with your talents for God? Some of us may not be as talented as others. Some of us may be more talented than others. It doesn't matter the level of your ability. What do you do with what you have? In 1 Peter chapter 4, in verse 10, Peter told those, whatever gift you have received, whatever that gift is, and that gift does not necessarily have to be a miraculous gift. In 1 Peter 4:10, it could have just been a non-miraculous talent, ability that they were born with. He says, whatever you have, use it to minister unto others as good stewards of the grace of God. What do you do? How much do you do with what you have? How much do you do with the money that you have? Somebody says, well, I don't have much money. That doesn't matter. How much do you do for the Lord with what you have? Adonijah didn't have much. And yet he was a man who did so much, but he didn't have very much to start with. How much are you doing for the Lord? Look at the second man that we're introduced to in verse 9. He's called Eleazar in verse 9. After him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo. Let that sink in for a minute, for those of you of fun intelligence. After him was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahoite. One of the three mighty men with David when they defied the Philistines who were gathered there for a battle. And there the men of Israel had retreated. Well, what was Eleazar? He was a man of Israel. Where did all of his comrades go? Where did all of his brothers go? Where did everybody else go? They took off. Here's the Philistines and everybody abandons. What is Eleazar going to do? Verse 10, he arose and attacked the Philistines, and this is one of my favorite parts in the Bible, until his hand was weary and his hand stuck to the sword. The Lord brought about a great victory that day, and then what happened? Then the people returned after him only to plunder. Isn't that great? You go and do all the work, and then everybody else comes and takes up all the goodies when you're done. It's kind of like kids, right? You do all the work, and your kids come along and get all the goodies. Anyway, here is Eleazar. Everybody else leaves. All of his countrymen abandon him. And what does he do? He fights unrelentingly. I had it and then I lost it. He fought unrelentingly. But he fought by himself. What does it take? What does it take so that your hand gets stuck to the sword? I mean, we're not talking about that he put super glue on it. We're not talking about that he put some kind of adhesive on it. We're talking about the fact that he fought so unrelentingly that when, as he's going through the battle, he's growing weary, but then he can't take his hand off of the sword. How determined do you have to be? How tired do you have to be to where you cannot even pry your fingers from the sword? You ever driven through a rainstorm where you're gripping the steering wheel so tight. Have you ever driven through one of those nice hailstorms? Ever driven through, maybe not around here, but further north, one of those nice snowstorms where those of you who live in Florida, it's pretty cool. Sometimes you can turn your high beams on and it looks like Star Wars when you're driving through this snowstorm. Looks like you're in Star Wars because that's all you can see. You can't see anything else. But have you ever gripped the steering wheel so tight that once you get to wherever you're going, you have to start flexing your fingers to get them to move? He fought so hard and unrelentingly, he could not get his hand off of his sword. I want to ask you, is that the way you're serving the Lord? Will you stick to it so long? Will you stick to it so hard to the work of the Lord that it's as if your hand becomes stuck to the wheel, as if your hand becomes stuck to the sword, no matter how tired you get, no matter how weary you become, and no matter how many people are not there with you and not fighting with you, will you stick with it? That had to be one of the hardest things for Eleazar. Not only the fact that he's fighting all of these people, but he's fighting them alone, and he's fighting them alone because everybody else has abandoned him. It's hard to be a Christian sometimes, isn't it? You ever feel like Elijah sometimes where you think, I'm the only one who's trying to do what's right? Elijah felt that way. He ran off and hid in a cave. Sometimes we want to do that. We want to run off and hide in a cave. Why am I the only one? Folks, are we going to stick to it? Are we going to stick to the task that the Lord has given to us? Parents, are we going to stick to the task that God has given to us in the home? Young people, are you going to stick to the task that God has given to you? Well, everybody else is doing it, or everybody else gets to go there, or everybody else gets to do this, or everybody else has one of these, so I need to have one of these. Sometimes, as even Chris talked about this morning, we allow our focus to become so worldly-minded that we forget about where our focus needs to be, and that is on the task of God and sticking to the task of God so much that we cannot, not that, it's just that we cannot and we will not let go of it. Parents, it's hard sometimes to say no when you know you need to say no. Will we stick to the task that God has given to us? Will we stick to the task that God has given to us in the workplace? To be those holy, set-apart people in the workplace who no matter what other values are being presented in that place, no matter what other ethics might be violated in the workplace, that you stand up and you are accounted for righteousness. Will you fight for the Lord? Will you stick to the task that He's given to us? In our community, in our nation, will you be the one who doesn't give up, who doesn't give in, no matter how hard the going gets? Will you be the one who says, I'm not going to quit? Eleazar didn't have any quit in him. He didn't know the concept. It wasn't in his vocabulary. He fought to the point, yeah, he was tired, but he was not going to let go of the sword. Young people, I beg of you, don't let go of the sword. Don't let go of the sword of the Spirit. Don't let go of the Word of God. Grab it in your hand and write it upon your heart in order that the example that we might set before others will show forth the determination that we have that I'm going to fight. And I'm going to fight unrelentingly even if nobody else will. Look at this third man. Down in verse 11. Here's Shema. And we had a lot of babies here this morning, all the families that are gathered here for the holidays and all these babies. If anybody's pregnant, you might find, you know, some, I know you like buying these baby name books, but, you know, Adono, Eleazar, Shema. I don't know anybody named that, so if you want a unique name, Abishai. I don't know anybody named Abishai or Benaiah. Anyway, verse 11, here's Shema. After him was Shema, the son of Agi. See, you don't know anybody named Agi. Name your kid Agi. The Hararite. The Philistines had gathered together into a troop. where there was a piece of ground full of lentils. So what all the people do? Same thing they did in the day of Eleazar. So all the people fled. These are a bunch of cowards. How would you like to be an Israelite? Every time something bad happens, every time the going gets tough, where do your friends go? They're bailing out. The nation of Israel fled from the Philistines. Verse 12, Shema stationed himself in the middle of the field, defended it, and killed the Philistines. So the Lord brought about a great victory. Here's Shema. What does Shema do? Everybody else flees and gets out of town. What does Shema do? He takes a stand. He takes a stand and he defends his ground. He takes a stand in the middle of the field and he defends it. He's not going to let the Philistines have that field. He's there when everybody else is gone. The lessons are very similar to that of Eleazar because everybody else is gone. But here's a man who was not going to give up that which belonged unto God. He was not going to see it compromised. He was not going to see it taken. He was not going to see the enemies come and run over it. He took a stand in the middle of the field and he defended it. It's a lesson obvious. What are we going to do? Will you take a stand? Will you stand firmly in the faith? Not wishy-washy. Will you stand firmly in the faith with the determination that you will not give in, that you will not give up, but that you will defend it, unwilling at all to yield? Think about what Paul says in the New Testament, where he talks about the fact that they were not, in the book of Galatians, they were not willing to yield even for an hour. And that's talking about dealing with brethren. When it comes to truth, we have a responsibility to stand on the truth. To stand on the truth and to stand for the truth. This is God's territory. The truth of God is just like Shema standing in God's territory. This is God's territory. We need to stand in the middle of it, not ashamed of it, but stand in the middle of it and be ready to defend it. Look at Ephesians chapter 6 for just a minute. See how many times you see the word stand in Ephesians chapter 6. Here's Paul as he's closing this letter. And he's talking to them, he's about ready to talk to them about the armor of God that they are to put on. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10, he says, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might." And then start in verse 11 and go down through verse 14. See how many times he tells these Christians to take a stand. Verse 11, Ephesians 6, "Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." Brethren, we need to stand. We need to defend the truth. We need to stand on God's ground. "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers, against rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand." There's the word again. "Withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Stand, therefore, having girded your waist with" what? "Truth." We need to be like Shema. We need to take a stand in truth and resolutely stand in the faith and say, "I'm not going to budge. I'm not going to move." We need to do all that we can to be that which that person is described in 1 Corinthians 15:58. Be immovable. Is that us? Not wavering. Not given to the latest whims, not given to the latest doctrines, not given to the latest trends in church etiquette that do not have biblical authority. In James chapter 1, in verse 5, James tells these people, "If anyone lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally." But then he goes on and talks about that person who does not seek wisdom from God. Talks about that man being unstable in all his ways. Talks about that man being tossed to and fro. Sometimes that's where people are when they don't take a stand on the truth, for the truth. We need to be those who are studying the truth. "Study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth, rightly handling the word of truth." That needs to be us. You and I need to stand in the middle of that field. We need to defend that which God has given unto us. That's what he's told us to do. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15. The Bible tells us to sanctify Christ as Lord in our hearts. And to always, not sometimes, not whenever it's convenient, to always be ready to give an answer, a defense. To who? To everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that's in you with meekness and fear. We need to be ready in a moment's notice to give a defense. Jude verse 3, Jude calls upon Christians to earnestly contend for the faith. We don't need to be ashamed of the gospel of Christ. We need to be those who readily proclaim it, who readily defend it, and stand up for that which is right. Folks, if we don't do it, if you and I don't stand in the middle of the field, if you and I don't stand on truth and stand for truth, name somebody who's going to. Who's going to fill that gap? Who's going to stand in the gap where truth is needed if it's not going to be you or me? We need to be like David's mighty men. Drop down to verse 18, where we see the fourth man that I want us to see tonight, and that's Abishai. What do you notice about Abishai and down in verse 18? Abishai was the brother of Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was chief of another three. He lifted his spear against 300 men. He killed them and he won a name among these three. Was he not the most honored of these three? Therefore, he became their captain. However, he did not attain to the first three. You have the first three here in Adonai, Eleazar, and Shema. But here comes Abishai, and he makes for himself a great name, and he does many great things, but he wasn't the greatest. He did so many great things that he got a great name, and he became their captain, but the end of verse 19 says, but he did not attain to the level of those first three. He was great, but he was great without being the greatest. Can you settle for that? Can you settle for being used by God to do great things? Can you settle for being used by God to do wonderful works and be content without being top dog, without being the greatest, without getting the accolades? Some of the greatest compliments that I think are paid to people in this church is when someone will say, and we thank all of those who worked behind the scenes. You know, things can't happen with people who don't work behind the scenes. With people that are not seen, not known, not named, and yet they are like this man. They're like Abishai. They do great, marvelous works for the Lord and for His church, but they may not get the accolades. They may not get the praise of a Shema or an Eleazar or an Adonai. But folks, does that matter? What does it matter if we are one of the greatest as long as we are doing great things? You see, we're never going to be the greatest because God's the greatest, period. God is greater than anything or anyone that we can know. So there's no way that we're ever going to be on par with God. Remember what John the Baptist said in John 3:30 about Jesus? He must increase, and I must decrease. That needs to be our relationship with God. God needs to increase in my life, and I need to decrease in my life. And this is the man that Jesus said in Matthew chapter 11, there's no one on this earth greater than John the Baptist. Jesus sets up John the Baptist, and John the Baptist says, no. He's got to increase. I've got to decrease. God's greater than everyone. But here's what's hard for us to grab a hold of. And that is that we need to allow others to be greater than us. We don't need to seek prestige. We don't need to seek honor. What do we need to seek? Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4 says, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others, you know the next word, better than himself. That's hard. To esteem you better, to esteem you greater than myself. Let each of us look out not only for his own interest, but also the interest of others. You remember in Matthew 25 when that master came along and he passed out the talents to these three men? Folks, I don't know how many five-talent people there are in this congregation. I think there's a lot. But I think of a lot of us, me included, are like that two-talent guy. We're not going to reach the five-talent level. And that's okay. Here's this two-talent guy. Did he go and pout? Oh, I didn't get five talents. You know, I'm good enough to get five talents. Where's my five talents? I deserve five talents too. You see him going on a tirade because he didn't get the attention? What does he do? He goes and works. He doubles what the master had given unto him. He did great. He wasn't the greatest. Here's a five-talent guy. But he took what he had and he did something great with it. Or are we going to be like the one-talent guy? It's okay to be a one-talent guy too. As long as we don't take, back to this first point, as long as we don't take what little we have and not use it for the Lord. Here's Abishai. All he was concerned about was God's work. And he was satisfied with God. He was satisfied with God getting the attention. He was satisfied with the others getting the praise as long as he was able to do the work for God. Is that where we are? Last man, down in verse 20. I don't know if you're still looking. Maybe Benaiah is a good name for you to think about. Verse 20. Benaiah was the son of Jehoiada. There's another one for you. I hope you're writing these down. Pass them on to your grandchildren. The son of Jehoiada. The son of a valiant man from Kabzeel, who had done many deeds. What had he done? He had killed two lion-like heroes of Moab. He also had gone down and killed a lion in the midst of a pit on a snowy day. And he killed an Egyptian, a spectacular man. The Egyptian had a spear in his hand, so he went down to him with a staff, wrested the spear out of the Egyptian's hand, and killed him with his own spear. Verse 20 says that he had done many deeds. What had he done? Think about this. This man accomplished the difficult. How many of you would like to fight a lion? That's not an easy task, right? I mean, we read about Samson doing it, we read about David doing it. Oh, well, you know, these guys, they could fight lions. Folks, they're just like you and me. And they killed lions? They don't do that without the Lord's help, okay? That's not going to happen without the Lord's help. So here's Benaiah. He killed a lion. Oh, big deal, right? Well, it's like these gladiator things you see on TV. Oh, well, let's not just make it a wrestling match. Let's put them in a cage, you know? And let's not just put them in a cage. Let's, you know, blindfold them, you know? They got to put all these obstacles. He fights a lion in a pit. Oh, that's good, right? I mean, it'd be one thing to fight a lion out in the wild, out in a field somewhere. He's in a pit with a lion. That's bad news already, right? I mean, close quarters and a lion. And what else does the Bible tell us? God throws this detail in here, and I think it's cool. It happens on a snowy day. Sorry for those of you who have never seen snow, but that kind of messes up your footing, you know? If you've ever watched football games during the snow, it kind of messes up their footing, right? They got to go get longer cleats. I don't think Benaiah went and, you know, got longer cleats, you know, for his fighting the lions. Maybe they were the Detroit Lions and he didn't need cleats because, you know, it didn't matter. Anyway, here he is fighting this lion in a pit on a snowy day. He accomplished the difficult. It's like the gladiator match. What else can we throw into this to make it more difficult? He accomplished the difficult. Here's this Egyptian. How did the New King James describe him? He was a spectacular man. Here's a man, if you read over, I think it's in the parallel account in 1 Chronicles chapter 11. Says that this man is 5 cubits tall. Anybody in here 5 cubits tall? He's 7.5 feet tall. Oh, no big deal. He wasn't as tall as Goliath, right? He's 7.5 feet tall. He's got a spear that's like a weaver's beam. That's huge. The tip on it alone would have been about 50 pounds. I don't know about you, but if a spear tip is 50 pounds, I'm in trouble already. You know, I mean, the spear could weigh nothing and it would still hurt. The spear tip alone's 50 pounds. Here's Benaiah. Oh, well, you know, here's this Egyptian. This Egyptian had a spear in his hand. What does Benaiah have in his hand? Oh, he's got a staff. Oh, that's nice. Here's Benaiah with his shepherd's staff. You know, one of those things that got the nice little hook on the top so you can pull the sheep along. Oh, that's good, right? Here's 7.5 foot tall Egyptian versus Benaiah with his staff. Oh, that's good. And so what does he do? The Bible says he goes and he rests. How did he get the spear away from this giant? He wrested the spear away from him and then killed him with his own spear. He accomplished the difficult. How did he do that? How did he kill a lion in a pit on a snowy day? How did he wrest the spear away from this huge guy and kill him with his own spear? The same way you and I live the Christian life. Christian living, faithful living, is difficult. That's not my word, that's Jesus' word. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 14, narrow is the way, and narrow is the gate, and difficult is the way. Jesus, New King James, says, it's difficult to live the Christian life. If you go over to Luke's account in Luke chapter, why isn't it up there? If you go over to Luke's account in Luke chapter 13 and verse 24, is where Jesus says, agonize to enter into the kingdom. Strive to get, it takes effort. That's why Paul frequently used the terminology that it's like a fight. Fight the good fight of faith, he told Timothy. He says at the end of his life that he had fought the good fight. You ever feel that way? You ever feel that the Christian life, Christian living, faithful living, not just being a Christian, but being a faithful Christian. But young people, when you get married, sometimes we encourage our young people to marry a Christian, and I hope you will marry a Christian. But let me add one more thing to that. Don't just settle for any Christian. Marry a faithful Christian. There's a difference. There's a difference between somebody who's a Christian and somebody who's a faithful Christian. Being a Christian can be difficult. Being a faithful Christian, Jesus says, is difficult. It's like a fight. Well, what are we going to do? We need to be like Benaiah. Did it bother him that he was stuck in a pit with a lion on a snowy day? In 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8, what does God call the devil? A roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. We've got our own lion in our own pit. Except we live in South Florida, it's not a snowy day. But hey, as long as we don't have to deal with a snowy day, that's okay. We've got our own battles that we're fighting. We have those things as being a Christian that are difficult. How are we going to get through it? How are we going to beat the lion? The same way Benaiah did. We're going to do it with the Lord's help. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. And lean not on your own understanding. In how many of our ways? In all of your ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct your paths. Folks, that's a promise from God. Promise of God is, if you'll be like Benaiah, if you'll put your trust in Him, you can accomplish the difficult. I hope that we will take something from Adono, something from Eleazar, something from Shema, something from Abishai, something from Benaiah, and say, that's who I want to be. That's what I want to do. And in 2010, not to become one of David's mighty men, but to become one of God's mighty men. You remember who came to David? Everyone who is distressed. Are you distressed? Everyone who is in debt, are you in debt? You look at all of those who came to David, and it seems like every one of them that came to David had a need. Does everybody who comes to God, do they have a need? Everybody in this world has a need. Everyone who comes to God, they don't come to God because of what they can offer God. They come to God because they've got the greatest need in the world. And that's to be saved. Are you not one of David's mighty men? Are you one of God's mighty men? When I stood on that fireplace many years ago, before I could read apparently, so however old that made me, and led what was the number? It wasn't 714 because we had the old book. It was a different number, and I can't think of it. It'll come to me in a second. And I led Trust and Obey as the invitation song to myself because I was the only one there, except for the stuffed animals that were there, but they didn't listen anyway. It was before I could read, so I didn't know the words. All I knew about the song is what I heard people singing at church. You know how children don't always perceive or understand or hear things right? They're kind of like husbands. They don't always perceive or hear, understand things right. And so here's children. Here I was as a child, and all I knew about the song is what I had heard people singing. They were singing Trust and Obey, but that's not really what they were singing. They thought it was. But what they were really singing was Rusting Away, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus than to rust away. That's what they were singing. They just didn't know it. But in a little kid's mind, rusting away. And I thought, that's kind of weird. But hey, you know, I don't understand everything as a kid, so it's just rusting away. It was interesting when you grow up and you learn, that's not what God wanted me to do. He didn't want me to rust away. He wanted me to trust and obey. But really, those are the two options, aren't they? You either trust and obey God, or you can just rust away. You can either be used by God as a faithful Christian, or you can just rust away and do nothing. Which one are you tonight? You see, these, when we read 1 Samuel 22, we're told about 400 men who came to David. But you get to 2 Samuel 23, we don't read 400 men's names. We just read a handful of his mighty men and what they did for him. When the day of judgment comes, there have been billions and billions and billions of people who have lived on the face of this earth. But when God pulls up his list of mighty men, when God pulls up his list of faithful servants, it's not going to be everyone who's ever lived. It's going to be a select list of those who have trusted him and obeyed him. Do you believe tonight with all of your heart that Jesus is the Son of God? If you believe that, why don't you give your life to him tonight? Why don't you make up your mind to turn away from wrong? Turn away from sin. There's nothing that the song, I love the fourth verse of Trust and Obey where it says, this world has nothing left to give. We got to learn that. It has no new, no pure delights. There's nothing this world has to offer. So the rest of that verse says, try the life which Christians live. Be saved, oh, tonight. Why don't you do that? Come tonight, confess the faith, your faith, just like they did in Bible times, and be baptized into Christ. Just like Carl was this morning, just like every person in the New Testament times did, in order that they might be saved, in order that they might become one of God's children. And from this day forward, to serve Him faithfully. We're going to sing softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling. Will you say, I'm coming home? Why don't you come as together we stand and sing.